collaborating. No, Isval said. We've been careful and so has he. And Mors is an idiot. She sat up there on that moon for years and let Belcore run the show, undermining her at every turn. No, they just haven't told her that Vader and the Emperor are coming. They're replacing her, Cham, and making a big show of it. Probably bring in a garrison of stormtroopers, too. We're overdue for some heavier boots.
Cham nodded.
I think you're probably right. Then we're a go?
She was bouncing on the balls of her feet.
We're a go, Cham answered. And pity poor Belcore when he learns what he's actually signed on for. Isval stiffened.
He's filth, Cham. Imperial filth. Don't be sentimental. Not about him. Not about them. Not ever.
Her vehemence didn't surprise him, given what she'd experienced in her youth.
It's not sentiment. It's principle. What am I without that? On the winning side, I hope,
Isval said. She changed the subject.
Now what?
Now we get everything ready, Cham said.
And I mean everything.
This is the operation we've been waiting for. Mobilize everyone and get all the weapons and ships ready for use. We'll have full Imperial patrol schedules so we can move things into place. Let's find out if we're as good as we think we are.
We are, she affirmed. Consider it handled. But hear me. I'm heading back to Lesu for a day or two. I'll see to matters from there.
Cham turned to face her. Her beauty rarely registered with him, so often was it hidden behind the mask of her anger.
But right then, in the dim light of the moons, she looked as vulnerable as she had the day he'd first met her.
And as beautiful. He quieted the feelings for her that sometimes bubbled up. They were a complication he couldn't afford. She'd said not to be sentimental. He wouldn't be.
What's in Lesu? He asked, concerned.
The mask came back up. It's just personal business, all right?
He didn't pry. He had no right to pry.
All right. Just be careful. I'm always careful.
Sure you are, Cham said, smiling. Isval had rented another small garret in an underground housing complex in a poor part of Lesu. The thin walls allowed in noise from the adjacent rooms, shouting from one, shrill laughter from another. The smell of someone's dinner leaked through the shared ventilation system. Isval found she was hungry, but not for food.
The sight of Dre, with his impeccably combed hair, his unwrinkled, sharply creased clothes, his intolerably smug, self-assured expression, had made her need more acute.
She'd felt it coming on days before, like one of Ryloth's sandstorms, brewing red and blurry on the horizon, until finally it exploded in violence. She'd told Cham she'd be in Lesu 2 days, but she planned to use only the one. The need was too strong, the pressure, the agitation. She couldn't wait 2 days. She had to do it tonight. She had to. She'd be useless to Cham if she didn't, too sloppy, too angry. She needed release.
She knew how she appeared to others, with her pacing, her curtness, always on the verge of an explosion. Servitude had made her that way. If she was a monster, the Empire had spawned her. Her reflection stared back at her from the tiny mirror mounted on the wall. She'd donned a headband of the kind they loved, makeup to accent her high cheekbones, deep-set eyes, and full lips. It was the mask she wore when she hunted. It wasn't her in the mask. It was the her she'd been, but made monstrous. The pale blue expanse of her skin looked like still water. How often had she heard those words out of the lips of some Imperial? Too often. She imagined them thinking that if they were nice, if they dressed oppression up in fine words, they were then somehow giving her a choice. But they weren't. They were just lying to themselves about what they took from her and why she was forced to give it. She'd never had a choice, not a real one, not until she'd strangled that corporal with a headband and fled to the resistance. But she carried the scars. She'd always carry them, not on her skin, but on her soul. And she picked them open when she needed a reminder of pain or needed to add fuel to her anger. Servitude and its degradations had broken her. She knew she'd never put herself back together, not completely, but she didn't care. The break had made her jagged, and now she used her edges and points to cut them. They'd made her into something. A slave, a possession, a thing. But after she'd escaped them, the making had continued. She'd gone on hammering the metal of her spirit until she'd made herself into something new, a warrior, and often enough, a killer. And Cham Sin Dula had given her a place, and she loved him for that. For him it was a cause, but not for her. For her, it was just the vector she used to vent her anger against the Empire. She tried out a smile in the mirror as she hung a necklace around her neck, found the smile serviceable despite the sharpened eye teeth. She wore fitted pants and a shirt that showed her bare midriff. She threw a sheer, shimmering robe over the hole, knowing the robe hugged her curves as she moved. She hid a blaster in a holster at the small of her back and her vibroblade in the leg wraps around her left calf. She hesitated for a moment, recalling Cham's words about principles. She knew he would disapprove of what she did, of what she'd done a dozen times, and that his disapproval wouldn't be solely based in the risk she took, but also on principle. Principle. She paraphrased for herself a response to him, and it freed her to move. "We do what we must to win, Cham. They're filth, and they deserve what they get." She found she only half believed herself. Cham must have been influencing her more than she'd realized, but half was enough with the need on her. She headed out and up the stairs, past a drunk sleeping in a heap against the wall and onto the street. The thoroughfare filled her senses. The sounds of traffic and the hum of passers-by. The smell of cooking fires, spice pipes, and the sweaty, dry stink of a typical Ryloth night. The wind painted her robe against her form, and she felt eyes on her, gazes lingering on her sleek figure. But she ignored them. She hailed a service car with a raised arm, and her curves and makeup drew one quickly. She told the driver to take her to the Octagon, one of the main plazas in Lesu, bordered on all eight sides by cantinas and clubs, frequented by Imperials and working girls and men. She'd not hunted there before. The Octagon sat about halfway up Lesu's spire, dug deeply into the stone. The bottom level of the plaza was 30 meters down, and a series of carved stone stairways, tunnels, and balconies, all torchlit, led up to ever higher tiers and more stairways, creating a maze-like warren that eventually descended back to street level. Various cantinas and clubs were burrowed out of the stone, their interiors hidden from view. A steady stream of Imperial vehicles and smiling Imperial officers, often in the company of Twi'lek escorts, made their way to and from the Octagon's various levels. Pennons flapped in the wind, and lighted signs and paid hawkers advertised for this or that establishment. Isval eyed them from the window of her service car and hated them all. "Level 7, please," she said, and the driver set her down on one of the tiers of level 7, the second one down. The vehicle's door opened and the smells hit her instantly, the echoes of her previous life. Smoke and perfume and spice. Laughter and music bounced up from the lower levels. An older, paunchy officer in his dress grays eyed her as the service car flew off. He propositioned her with raised eyebrows and a knowing smirk, but she ignored him and headed down a nearby stairway. "Stack up!" he called after her. The maze was littered with dark corners, secret nooks, narrow tunnels, and blind alleys. Drunks and spice users and working girls lingered here and there, the castaways of Lesu's vice trade. As Isfal descended the octagon's tiers, the vices grew worse, the lighted signs more graphic. She'd spent her youth on level one, the hole as it was known, and the hole was where she would hunt. With a false smile and long-practiced skill, she avoided or extricated herself from the groping hands of drunk or spice-hazed Imperials on her way down. One of them removed himself too slowly, so she put a knee in his groin and left him moaning on a stairway. Laughter from above reminded her that she had to be careful about being seen. She was sweating by the time she reached the bottom, and the stink of level one brought it all back to her. The degradations, the hunger, the abuse, the constant, unrelenting desperation. Smoke and stink made a fog of the air.
Torches were rare. Signs were dim or unlit. Humans, Twi'lek, and other sentients moved through the dark, stifling air like ghosts, too ashamed of their tastes to engage in them in anything other than near darkness.
She moved among them, a ghost herself, looking for a likely spot and a likely target. She had both shortly. She sat in a nook not far from a spice and vice club, cloaked in the darkness and her anger, and watched a junior officer walk out of the club with a young, underfed Twi'lek girl on his arm. The escort had seen maybe 20 summers, and she wore barely enough clothing to cover herself. The officer pawed at her as they walked through the night, his sweaty face flushed with the heat and his expectations of what was to come. He leaned over, stumbling, and murmured something in her ear. She smiled, the false smile that Isval knew well and had worn often. She eyed him with contempt and growing rage. He was just some junior lieutenant, probably fresh off a transport from the Corps, who thought wearing dress grays and carrying a weapon gave him a claim on Ryloth's resources and women. Isval dug down to mine her resolve, found it, and stepped out of the nook. Her sudden appearance brought both the officer and the girl up short. But his surprised look quickly gave way to a leer as he looked Isval up and down. There was no one else in the immediate area. The officer's drink-reddened face split in a sloppy smile and slurred words emerged.
Aren't you pretty? Why don't you join us?
Isval sidled close, smiling, while she reached around to the small of her back. When she stood before him, she pulled the blaster and slammed his grip into his jaw. Teeth and blood spattered the street, and he fell in a groaning pile. The girl gave a single startled exclamation and looked as though she might run.
No, stay! Help me, Isval said. She disarmed the officer, grabbed him under the armpits, and dragged him back into the dark nook. The girl did not help her, but followed tentatively, warily.
What's your name?
Isval asked, standing over the officer. The girl blinked and said nothing.
I'm not going to hurt you, Isval said.
The officer moaned. His hand twitched. Isval stepped on it, felt a crunch, and the officer moaned again.
Ryan,
the girl said softly. Her eyes darted between Isval and the officer.
What are you... are you robbing us?
You and this...
She kicked the officer.
Aren't an us, no matter what he told you.
I don't... what?
Name your clan, Isval said.
Ryan looked away in shame.
You don't have one,
Isval said, nodding. She said what she'd said many times before.
Not anymore. Listen to me, Ryan. I used to stand where you're standing. I spent 3 years in the hole before I escaped.
There was no hope in Ryan's eyes.
Escape? There's no escape from this.
There is, if you want there to be.
Ryan looked up.
How?
Come with me. I'll take you out of here. I have a place you can stay,
start again, away from this.
I know. You don't trust me.
Why would you?
But my offer is genuine.
Ryan backed up a step as if Isfal had offered to harm her rather than help. Isfal was not surprised. Hope and trust didn't appear much among the workers in the Octagon.
I can't.
You can. You should. Look at me. Look. I'll help you.
She was shaking her head.
They'll come after me.
Isfal didn't lie.
They might. But they probably won't. They don't even know your full name. And once you're gone, you're gone. And if you want to, you can stay gone.
I can't.
The officer groaned. Isfal drew her vibroblade.
What are you going to do?
Ryan asked, horrified.
What should be done to all of them?
Isfal answered and knelt down, blade bare.
Don't!
Ryan said. She hurried forward and knelt beside Isfal, her eyes pleading. She placed her fingers on Isfal's wrist.
Don't, all right? I'll go with you, but don't do this.
I don't want you to come with me to save him.
Isfal snapped.
I want you to come with me to save you.
What's he to you?
Ryan glanced at the officer, back at Isfal.
He's nothing, but he didn't do anything bad to me.
He would have,
Isfal snapped. And he's a soldier of the Empire.
He's done something bad to all of us.
I know that, Ryan said. But don't, all right? Just don't. I'll come with you. I want to. I'm just afraid.
Voices from the walkway outside their nook froze them both into silence. But the sound soon passed.
This one owes you his life, then,
Isfal said. She stood and kicked the officer in the head. He didn't even groan, just went limp.
Come on. You can't go back to get anything.
There's nothing for me to go get.
Isfal took Ryan by the hand and walked her out of the pit, past the smoke and leers and spice and vice, ascending, and by the time she reached the top, she felt as light as she had in months. The feeling wouldn't last, she knew, but she'd enjoy it while it did. She wondered what Cham would think of her if he knew what she did, what she had to do. She thought he wouldn't understand. Cham preached principle. But only those who'd never descended to level one of the Octagon thought in terms of principle. Isfal knew better. Maybe Ryan knew better. The real world didn't well accommodate principles. When they reached the top of the Octagon, sweaty and out of breath, they fell in with the crowd there. Ryan looked about wide-eyed, breathed deep the night stink.
How long has it been?
Isfal asked.
Weeks since I left the hole,
Ryan answered. You still good? Isfal asked. This was the point when previous girls had turned back. Rarely, but it sometimes happened.
I'm good,
Ryan said.
Never go back,
Isfal said, and Ryan nodded.
Now let's get you home. A new home.
A service car took the two of them back to the garret Isfal had left earlier in the night. She led Ryan up the stairs, the drunk was still there, and into the garret.
It's not much,
Isfal said, showing the room to her. But it's safe and it's yours.
What do you mean? You're not staying? Isn't this your place?
No, it's yours. It's paid up through the year.
The year?
There's food in the cabinets and a few hundred credits in the drawer by the cooler. That ought to be enough to get you situated.
Hearing all that, Ryan looked unsteady. She reached for a chair, slid into it. Her eyes welled. Isfal stripped off her headdress, her clothing, and slipped back into her ordinary shirt, trousers, and weapons belt. Ryan watched her throughout.
I don't understand this, or you. What are you? Why are you doing this?
I told you,
Isfal said, looking in the small mirror. She took a rag, wet it from water in a jug, and wiped off the mask.
I used to be what you are, what you were. I just want to help. I wish someone had helped me.
That's not what I mean, Ryan said. Why me? I'm just a nobody.
You're not nobody. You're not.
I picked you by chance.
You were with an Imperial and you two were alone.
So you look for them? Imperials to kill? Why?
Isfal looked back at her by way of her reflection in the mirror.
You have to ask.
Ryan could not hold her reflected eyes.
Have you done that before? Killed Imperials?
This time Isfal looked back at her own reflection.
You have to ask.
Ryan said nothing, but she shivered.
I have a friend, Isfal said. He wants to save the whole planet. But that's too big for me, too much. I just want to save someone. A few people. Maybe you.
Ryan smiled. Isfal cleared her throat and gathered her things.
Take care of yourself, Ryan. I don't normally check back.
Dangerous for both of us.
Normally? You've done this for other girls?
I have.
Sounds like you've already saved a few someones. Can I ask how many?
Many. Doesn't matter.
And each time you...
Mentally, Isfal finished the sentence.
Killed someone? I'm going now, Isfal said.
Wait, I don't even know your name.
You don't need to. Goodbye, Ryan.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Not just for saving me, but for not doing it.
Isfal stopped in the doorway but didn't turn. Over her shoulder, she said,
Why do you care so much?
Ryan shook her head, shifted on her seat.
I don't know, but it has to stop sometime, doesn't it? The violence. The killing. Someone has to stop or it'll never end. Right? Maybe I'm saving you.
She laughed. Isfal looked down at her hands but didn't reply.
What is it? Ryan asked. Did I say something wrong? I'm sorry.
You didn't say anything wrong, Isfal said.
You probably didn't spend a lot of time in the hole, though.
Good fortune, Ryan.
Don't go back, all right?
That's it?
The girl asked.
That's it.
With that, Isfal left the garret. Another girl lifted out of bondage. Some of those she'd helped in the past had drifted back, but most didn't. Their new lives weren't easy, but at least they were no longer slaves. She hailed a service car, and as the vehicle moved off, Ryan's words replayed themselves for her.
It has to stop sometime, doesn't it?
Isfal didn't see how it could stop, not for her. She had the driver take her back to the Octagon Level 2.
You don't look like a Level 2 kind of lady, he said to her.
You'd be surprised, she answered.
She exited the car and headed down into the deeper dark. She found the nook soon enough, the Imperial still lying there semi-conscious, his hand broken, his face purpling from the blow she'd struck him. Spit and blood pooled on the ground near his mouth. She pulled her vibroblade and held it to his throat. His eyes blinked open. She imagined he could hardly see.
Don't,
he murmured. She stared at his pain-clouded eyes a long while, the blade ready. She lifted it from his neck. Ryan saved your life tonight, she said.
Remember that, because if you ever go looking for her, I'll come back. You hear me? You hear?
He groaned assent. She sheathed the knife.
So, it's settled that you'll live. But you still owe me pain.
She kicked him in the ribs once, twice, felt them give way with an audible snap.
He gasped in agony, moaned.
She stepped over him, straddling him, grabbed his shirt in her fist, and punched him in the face again and again until he was as limp in her grasp as a child's doll. She dropped him to the ground and stared at him, her breath coming hard. She looked at her knuckles, raw and bleeding, just like the rest of her. She was broken, and it would never stop. Not for her. Eyes watched her as she stepped out of the alley and headed up a nearby flight of stairs. By the time she'd put a full level behind her, she heard the shouts from below. She'd been sloppy, hadn't covered her tracks, hadn't, as Cham always warned her to do, thought through her exit.
But beatings happened often in the Octagon, and she appeared to be just another Twi'lek slave. She put three levels beneath her feet and still heard no pursuit.
By the time she'd retained another air car, the need was gone. She could once more think clearly, and her mind was already turning to the preparations she needed to make to ready things for the attack on Ta and Vader. Cham's plan was elaborate and extremely risky, but she loved the brazenness of it. They had 9 days to get everything ready.
Chapter 5.
Cham paced the cracked stone of the crowded landing bay. He smiled to himself, thinking he was worse than Isfahl. All he needed to do was grumble some, and the likeness would be perfect. The underground base on Ryloth's third moon seethed with activity. A mishmash of technology, droid ships, and weapons sat arrayed on the launch bay's floor, with dozens of Twi'lek engineers and droid assistants hovering over them like worried mothers. Parts and tools lay in neat arrangements on the floors, the workers and droids plucking what they needed as they needed it. No one even glanced up at him, so intensely were they focused on their work. Cham and his agents had been buying and stealing and building ships and weapons for years. During that time, he'd been filling weapons caches on Ryloth and Ryloth's moons from crates of small arms to makeshift landing bays filled with droid tri-fighters and vulture droid fighters.
He had a large force at his disposal, and he'd built it under the nose of the Empire, all with the compelled assistance of Belcor Drey.
Over the years, his engineers, but particularly Callan, who was a genius with artificial intelligence, had learned how to reprogram the brains in the droid fighters so they could operate without direction from a central droid control ship. They wouldn't be of much use in a dogfight with crude ships, but dogfights were not part of Cham's plan. He ran through the steps of the plan in his mind, doubts tugging at his resolve. He was committing everything, his people and his resources, to this one play. It would be worth it if he killed Vader and the Emperor. That could trigger a galaxy-wide rebellion, and in that chaos, with the Empire's resources spread thin, he could work to make Ryloth free. Otherwise, he didn't dwell on the otherwise. A free Ryloth, that was his goal. And if he had to bring down an empire to do it, he was prepared to do so. The tiny comlink implanted in his ear canal carried Isfahl's voice to him, as if she was speaking directly into his brain. She had a similar unit implanted, which allowed them to hear even each other's whispers, but not be overheard by nearby listeners. Cham's communications engineers had created a comm subnet that rode on a group of old Clone Wars satellites orbiting Ryloth along with the rest of the war's detritus.
The commsats gave the movement a secure private network all over the planet and just beyond the orbit of the farthest moon.
"All's ready down here," she said. "All three teams are briefed."
He bit down twice to activate the implant.
"You're on a decoy team, yes?"
She didn't hesitate before answering.
"No, I'm leading the primary. I have to."
"Isfahl!"
"There's no discussion here, Cham. I'm the best chance we have. Besides, I have to. For Pock."
He couldn't argue with her thinking or her sentiment, but the thought of losing her made his legs go weak. He relied on her too much, cared for her too much.
He remembered Pock's death, the sound of him choking, dying.
I know what you're thinking. But if this goes wrong, you won't need me anymore anyway. You won't even need you. There won't be much of a movement left to command.
She was right, and he knew it. Then let's make sure it doesn't go wrong.
I've checked and double-checked. I see it in my sleep.
Cham did too, and he'd triple-checked his thinking, and it all seemed solid. But they'd never planned anything on this larger scale with so many moving parts and contingencies.
If we don't bring down the shields, we abort.
If we don't short the shields, there'll be nothing to abort because we'll never even get started.
She was right about that too, and her calm helped steady him. Normally she was agitated and restless, but she turned as calm as still water when action impended. Cham was the opposite, normally calm and controlled, but antsy in the face of imminent action. He worried for his people, probably too much for a revolutionary. Once he'd have led missions like this, now he only planned them. I've become a bureaucrat, he muttered.
Just don't let yourself get lazy,
she joked, and he chuckled. Her tone turned serious.
When do the last droid ships go?
He glanced around at the 36 or so vulture droids arranged on the landing bay.
Tonight, I think, when Belcor gives us the all clear.
Belcor had provided them with information about Imperial patrols, incoming ships, and sensor scans. Cham had used the information to move the droid fighters and mines to the edge of the system unnoticed.
And speaking of bureaucrats, how's our little Belcor handling this?
Oh, I think he's seeing things in his sleep, too.
No indication he knows about Vader and the Emperor?
None. Cham paused, then said, 2 days, Isval. Our intel has the perilous prepping.
2 days. We're ready, Cham.
We're ready, he echoed,
saying it as though he could make it true by speaking with enough conviction. 2 days later, Cham sat in the makeshift command center on Ryloth's third moon. Three of his comrades shared the room with him. Gobi at the subspace transmitter, his stubby fingers ready to transmit commands. Zira, monitoring the sensor readouts from the probe droids, her heavy-lidded eyes taking in the rapid stream of data displayed on the screen. And Callan, the consulting engineer. Zira's data processing droid, D4L1, stood beside her chair, a hot link connecting him to the incoming data stream. 9 view screens mounted on the wall showed the outer reaches of Ryloth's system, as seen from the half-dozen probe droids they'd positioned in the system's asteroid belt. The rest of the droid ships they'd prepared lurked in the asteroid belt too, powered down to almost zero, waiting for Gobi's remote command to activate. A cloud of mines floated in space, ornaments hanging in the black, waiting for the perilous to emerge from hyperspace. For the 10th time in the past 10 minutes, Cham wondered if Belcor had lost his nerve and betrayed him, or given him bad information. And for the 10th time he forced himself to stop thinking about it. If Belcor had betrayed them, the movement would be crippled with nothing to show for it. But Belcor hadn't betrayed them. He couldn't, because Cham had made clear what the consequences would be. No, things were going as planned. And if they continued that way, then thousands of Imperials would soon be dead, including the Emperor himself.
Not a terrorist, he reminded himself, but a freedom fighter.
Everything he had worked to achieve for years was about to fail or bear fruit, and all he could do was watch it happen via instantaneous subspace transmission from over 600,000 kilometers away. A bureaucrat indeed.
Vader and the Emperor strode onto the central tier of the Perilous's bridge. Royal guards followed and took flanking positions at the main lift behind them.
Crew members scurried around or sat at their stations, all of them about the business of preparing a hyperspace jump for one of the Empire's most sophisticated, powerful starships.
Captain Lewitt stood near them, but kept a few paces of deck between them. He avoided looking directly at Vader, his discomfort with Vader's presence palpable. The captain turned to the Emperor, whose face was shrouded in the shadow of his hood.
I trust everything went well aboard the Defiance, my lord.
Hyperdrive is online and course is set, sir,
the helm called, and the information was echoed up to Lewitt.
I'd be honored if you'd give the order, my lord, said Lewitt.
Oh no, Captain, the Emperor said, waving a hand. I'm a political leader, not a military one. Proceed as you would normally.
Engage the hyperdrive, the captain called, and the command caused a ripple of activity to flow along the bridge crew. Vader felt the faint thrum in the deck as the Perilous's powerful hyperdrive engaged. Stars and the black of space disappeared, replaced by the blue churn of hyperspace.
En route to Ryloth, called the helm.
Dim the view, Lewitt ordered,
and the transparasteel darkened until hyperspace was no longer visible. He turned to the Emperor.
My lord, if you and Lord Vader would prefer to retire to your quarters, I will let you know the instant we arrive in Ryloth's system.
I think we will remain on the bridge for now, Captain,
the Emperor said.
Very good, sir,
said Lewitt, pursing his lips under his bristly gray mustache.
It won't be long.
The captain moved off, looking over the shoulders of his crew, issuing orders and otherwise staying away from Vader. The bridge crew settled into its rhythm.
I think you make him uncomfortable, Lord Vader,
said the Emperor. Vader made most of the naval officers he encountered uncomfortable. To them, he was a towering dark figure outside their chain of command, who had emerged from nowhere and possessed powers they did not understand.
His discomfort is useful to me.
Underlings should always be uncomfortable in the presence of their superiors,
said the Emperor.
Don't you agree?
Vader understood the question behind the question and answered accordingly.
Yes, my master.
Good.
The two surveyed the bridge in a silence, broken only by the rasping of Vader's respirator, while the Perilous crossed parsecs in a blink. After a time, the bridge crew broke into a different rhythm as they prepared to return the Star Destroyer to normal space.
Coming out of hyperspace, called the helm. Coming out of hyperspace, aye,
the call echoed up the bridge.
And the test begins,
the Emperor said. Vader looked at his master, head tilted in a question, not taking his meaning until he too felt the disturbance in the Force.
A ship is coming out of hyperspace, Zira said, her voice pitched high from excitement.
Cham realized he had been clenching his fists for the last 30 minutes.
Activate the mines. Let's pen them in. Shield bleeders on standby.
Callan's head tails bobbed with nervousness, and his purple skin looked so pale as to be lavender. The bleeders were his brainchild. As always, he mumbled to himself under his breath. Cham put a hand on Gobi's shoulder.
Be ready to transmit to the droid ships, Gobi.
I'm more than ready, Cham, Gobi said, shaking with excitement or tension. Let's force-feed these Imperials some fire.
Let's do just that, said Cham. Not a terrorist, but a freedom fighter.
As the Perilous emerged from hyperspace on the outer edge of Ryloth's system, the mammoth viewport undimmed, giving a view of several distant gas giants and the nearby belt of asteroids that divided the outer system from the inner. The system star burned orange and bright in the distance. Ryloth itself was too far away to be visible.
Maximum acceler-,
began the captain. But before he finished, an impact sounded from starboard, and the huge starship vibrated. heads came up from stations and looked questions at one another. A second impact followed hard after. Then a third, larger than the rest, caused the ship to list. Vader eyed the viewscreen, saw nothing. His master stared at the floor, a strange half-smile on his face.
Situation!
The captain ordered, his voice calm.
Sir, I'm a...
Another impact shook the ship. A fourth. Another. Another. The ship listed farther. Alarms blared.
We have electrical shorts and a few fires all over the ship,
the duty officer called.
Injuries reported.
What is happening, Captain?
Vader stepped forward and grabbed Lewitt by the arm, hard enough to elicit a pained grimace.
Lewitt looked at Vader, at the Emperor, and barked at a scan officer.
Situation, scan!
Mine, sir,
the scan officer said.
Hundreds of them everywhere!
Mines,
the captain repeated.
Full stop! Weapons online!
More explosions shook the ship, and a dozen mines floated into the viewscreen's field of view. They came in all shapes and sizes, some huge square cubes with magnetic sensors, others spiked spheres with kinetic detectors. Vader recognized a few as modern in design, others from the Clone Wars era, others from still earlier. The shields will prevent any real damage to the ship, my lord, Captain Lewitt said to the Emperor. My apologies for this inconvenience.
Perform a deep scan on this area of the system, particularly on the asteroid belt. I sense something.
Captain Lewitt pursed his lips in impatience.
My lord, this is probably just a grouping of mines left over from the Clone Wars and floating in the outer system. I've heard of it happening. They present no threat to us.
Vader put a finger in the captain's face.
Do as I have instructed, Captain.
Lewitt's brow furrowed, but he dared not disobey.
As you wish, Lord Vader. Scan! Begin to...
Another series of explosions boomed against the ship's shields, sending tremors through the deck.
No damage!
Someone on the bridge crew called.
Shields holding! Sir! There are still over 300 mines out there!
Said the scan officer. Lewitt couldn't bring himself to make eye contact with Vader. To the Emperor, he said,
My lord, I think perhaps it would be best if you vacated the bridge.
Quite the contrary, said the Emperor. This is precisely where I belong.
The scan officer leaned over his instruments.
I'm getting unusual readings, sir. I think you should see this.
What is it?
Lewitt asked, irritable, though he hustled to the scan station.
Vader followed hard after, looming over the captain and the crew member.
This,
the scan officer said, pointing at the readings on his screen. Vader and Lewitt took them in and both understood their meaning. Lewitt cursed and stood up straight.
Sound battle stations! Helm! Full reverse! There are mines on all sides of us, sir! If we reverse, I don't care! Full reverse, now!
It's too late for that, Captain.
Vader activated a remote on his armor to get his interceptor prepped for flight.
Alert your flight teams,
he said to Lewitt.
Be ready to scramble your V-wings.
What? Why?
Lewitt asked, looking from Vader to the Emperor.
The shields are still up.
Likely not for much longer.
Do as Lord Vader commands,
said the Emperor, putting just enough power in his tone to quail everyone on the bridge.
Give the command,
Lewitt said to the duty officer,
and double the power to forward shields.
D4L1 beeped at Zira, and she nodded in response.
Perilous is reversing.
They detected the bleeders,
Cham said. They all watched the screens as the proximity mines to the rear of the Perilous blossomed into fire. One, five, a dozen, 2 score. Looks like very little damage from the mines so far,
so far, Gobi said, nearly bouncing in his chair.
Callan muttered under his breath, tapping the table at which he sat with a forefinger. On the wall-mounted screens, Cham could see the enormous Star Destroyer from various angles, the image occasionally obscured by an asteroid spinning in front of one of the probe droids. Hundreds of unexploded mines floated in space around the enormous ship, trailing after it as it moved into reverse. The next step was the critical one. He could feel Callan's eyes on him. He'd wanted the ship a bit closer to the asteroid belt, but there was nothing for it.
Activate the shield bleeders now, Cham said, and Gobi nodded.
You can do it,
Callan said, and kept mumbling the phrase under his breath like an incantation.
You can do it.
They watched the screens, seeing through the eyes of the probes. Callan had re-engineered 24 of the mines. When they contacted a ship's shields, they wouldn't explode, but rather latch onto the shield's energy signature, set up a counter-grid, and, in theory, weaken them enough for ships to get through.
Cham could not tell which mines were rigged to explode and which were programmed to bring down the shields, but he could tell when the bleeders hit the Perilous's shields and activated.
The area of space around the huge ship grew a series of glowing lines, veins in the shield's protective field that extended out from each of the bleeders toward the others. The shields visibly flickered as the lines expanded. The Perilous looked like it was trapped in a glowing net.
Caught a big fish, Gobi said.
Maybe, Cham thought, still not quite willing to let himself believe.
You can do it, Callan mumbled to the bleeders. You can.
Talk to me, Callan, said Cham.
Callan studied the data coming over Zero's comp. D4L1 chirped something that Callan must have disliked. He swatted the droid in a silver dome.
I think it's working, Callan said.
He glanced up at the screen, at the net that surrounded the Perilous.
It looks like it's working.
But is it?
Cham asked.
Shields are weakening,
Zira said, also studying the data.
We go then,
Cham said. To Gobi.
Launch all the droid ships.
Gobi issued the signal. Through the eyes of the probes, they saw a fleet of several hundred vulture droids speed out of the asteroid field.
This is it!
Gobi said.
This is it,
Cham softly echoed.
What is that?
Lewitt asked. The view screen showed a dense matrix of glowing lines, like bolts of lightning, tracing jagged paths along the shields.
Shields at 50%,
the scan officer said, his tone going from puzzled to alarmed.
17! Back to 25!
Get them back up to full,
Lewitt commanded.
Full stop,
Vader ordered, and Lewitt did not countermand. With the shields weakening, they couldn't risk slamming into the mines all around them. The helm put the Perilous into a stop, and the scan officer tapped his screen.
Captain, some of the mines aren't mines. They're devices, creating some kind of feedback loop in the shield matrix. They're not bringing the shields down, but they're weakening them, opening holes in places.
An uncomfortable rustle went through the bridge crew. Vader looked at his master, but the Emperor seemed lost in thought, a faint smile raising the corners of his thin-lipped mouth. Lewitt stalked from station to station, studying readouts, and when he spoke, his voice was tense.
Get it fixed. Weapons, get a lock on those devices and bring them down.
There are hundreds of mines out there, sir,
the weapons officer said.
A miss with the shields weakened could create a chain reaction of explosions.
Then don't miss,
Lewitt said.
Sir, said the scan officer, I can't be certain which is a regular mine and which isn't.
There are too many and they're too small.
Lewitt swallowed hard. No doubt he felt as trapped as the Perilous. He looked back at the Emperor at Vader, back at his bridge crew. Another crew member added, "The mines have proximity attractors. If the shields fall, they'll be drawn close and then explode." Another uncomfortable rustle went through the crew. The Perilous couldn't move and yet had to move.
"I need options,"
Lewitt said, and the crew buried themselves in data. Vader gave him one.
"Launch your fighter squadrons. I'll lead them."
Whatever discomfort Lewitt had with Vader gave way in the face of the crisis. He nodded, relieved.
"Of course. The fighters can take out the mines with precision."
"Sir!"
said the scan officer, his voice pitched high with controlled alarm.
"There are several hundred vulture droids swarming out of the asteroid belt. They're heading directly for us. Battle stations!"
Lewitt said, and alarms began to blare. Vader turned to the Emperor to speak, but before he could say anything, the Emperor said,
"You intend to suggest that I remove myself to a safer location? To my shuttle, perhaps, or to my quarters?"
Vader nodded. His master often knew his thoughts.
"I think I shall remain here and watch matters unfold," the Emperor said. "But you should do as you intended."
"Yes, Master."
Vader bowed and strode for the lift. As he approached, the doors opened to reveal a fretful Ornfree Tarr. The Twi'lek waddled out of the lift, large ears sagging, jowls and belly bouncing, and stared at the view screen with alarm.
"Oh my! What's happening?"
"Greetings, Senator,"
the Emperor said. And before Tarr could reply, Vader gestured with his hand and used the Force to fling the Senator out of his path. Tarr hit the bulkhead with a gasp and sank to the ground at the feet of one of the Emperor's royal guards.
"Lord Vader is in a hurry," the Emperor said. "Forgive him."
Vader entered the lift, turned, and stared at Tarr as the doors closed. He had little time. The moment the lift doors opened on the flight level, he hurried through the corridors of the Perilous, finally taking the lift down to the fighter bay. Scores of V-Wings sat in neat rows along the flight deck, engines already engaged. The blaring alarms had the flight deck buzzing. Pilots in their flight suits hurried to their ships, and a dozen mech droids wheeled along, beeping and whirring. Eschewing the cockpit ladder, Vader used the Force to leap atop his interceptor and slide into his seat. As he strapped himself in and the canopy descended, the squadron commander's voice came over his helmet comm.
"What are we facing out there, sir?"
"Mines and vulture droids at a minimum, Commander."
"Vulture droids? Been a while since I've seen those, sir."
"Launch when ready,"
Vader said to the squadron as the anti-gravs lifted his ship off the deck. Dozens of V-Wings followed suit. The commander synced the fighters' identifications with the bridge comp, so they could be easily distinguished from the incoming vulture droids and mines.
"Clear to launch,"
said the bridge officer.
"Lord Vader,"
Lewitt's voice said over the private channel.
"The shields are at 16%.
"Understood, Captain."
Vader engaged his ion engines. His interceptor accelerated out into open space.
Chapter 6.
"Can you magnify on the launch bay?" Cham asked, and Callan, still muttering, made it happen. One of the screens on the wall gave a close-up of the Star Destroyer's belly launch bay. And through the glowing net of the dying shields, they watched dozens of V-Wings pour out of it. Cham had anticipated a fighter contingent. A third of the vulture droids would engage with the V-Wings. The rest would continue on their mission.
"Status of the shields?"
he asked Callan. Callan shook his head.
"Too far out for accurate readings, but..."
As they watched, the net of lines surrounding the Perilous flared and expired. The shields were down.
"Well," Callan said, sitting back in his chair and grinning, "I think we have an accurate reading after all. They're down."
Yes!
Gobi exclaimed, and slammed his fist on the table, spilling his calf. Even Cham couldn't contain a smile. Vader saw the shields flare and fail even before Luit's frantic call came over the comm.
Shields are down, Lord Vader!
Scores of mines, drawn by their attractor arrays, floated toward the ship, gradually picking up speed, and hundreds of droid fighters chewed up the space behind them, swarming toward the vulnerable ship. Vader wheeled his interceptor toward the mines and the oncoming vulture droids. He sensed a greater threat in the droids than he did the mines.
Free all batteries to fire on the mines, Captain.
The V-Wing Squadron Commander's voice carried over the comm.
10 seconds before vultures are in range. Target the mines in the interim.
Vader fell into the deep well of anger that sat in his core, used it to center him in the Force, and flew entirely by feel.
He targeted a mine, fired, watched it vaporize, and flew through the flames. Wheeling right, he targeted another, and another, destroying a mine with every shot. The explosion sometimes set off nearby mines, and space was soon filled with a network of concurrent detonations. Vader spun and whirled through the chaos.
There are too many to get even half,
said one of the pilots.
Droids closing,
the squadron commander said.
Break off and engage the droids.
Around him, the Star Destroyer's formidable batteries of weapons scribed lines of ionized plasma on the velvet of space. Mines exploded to Vader's left and right. He circled wide and up, buzzing the Perilous's bridge as he fired on another mine. Another. And yet there were too many.
The first of the mines reached the hull of the Star Destroyer, latched on to the bulkhead, and blossomed into fire. 2, 8, 12, 24. The explosions shot long tongues of flame into space.
Debris and bodies flew out of the blast holes and into the vacuum. Vader could imagine the fires, the death, the blaring alarms. Vader flew above the huge pyramid of the ship, hugging Perilous's superstructure and destroying 3 mines before they could connect to the hull and focus their blast into the ship's bulkhead. Their explosions did superficial damage, but didn't breach the ship.
Droids in range,
the squadron commander said.
Regroup and take attack formations.
Cham stared at the screens, his jaw clenched, his shoulders hunched as the forces closed. The fighters looked tiny against the backdrop of the Star Destroyer, blood flyers to a lilac. The dark of space around the Perilous was alight with weapons, fire, and explosions. Gobi hissed with glee each time a mine struck the Star Destroyer and birthed fire. Cham knew that Kallan's re-engineered vulture droids were not as maneuverable as they would be otherwise, not with their cargo and turgid brains. They would be no match for the V-Wings, but Cham only needed a fraction of them to get through for the damage to the Perilous to be crippling. Fly, fly, little birds, he whispered. The secure comm he wore in his ear pinged. Isval.
Speak, he said softly. Preliminary word of the attack is arriving planetside. It's chaos down here.
Intercepts? He asked her.
Not that I can tell, but I'm sitting in a repair ship. I'm sure it won't be long, though.
Cham looked up at the screen.
They'll be too late to stop this. How's it going?
She asked. Cham stared at the screen. Vultures are closing. You ready?
We're ready, she said.
I'll be in touch, he said, and broke the connection. On the screen, the fighters, vultures on the one hand, V-Wings on the other, lit up space with weapons fire.
And here we go!
Gobi said. The approaching cloud of vulture droids opened fire as one, their repeating blasters spitting dashes of red energy through the void. Vader swung his interceptor away from the Perilous, burning from dozens of mine explosions, and flew directly toward the oncoming vultures.